All right, I think we might make a start. It's my pleasure to introduce Professor Wayne Hall, who is currently the NHMRC Australia Fellow at the University of Queensland's Centre for Clinical Research, and also Brain Institute. Wayne's really a very big name in neuroethics in general, but in the neuroethics of addiction and mental illness in particular, and so really looking forward to his talk on deep brain stimulation as a treatment for addiction. So just join me in welcoming Wayne.
Thanks for that introduction, Bennett. Just acknowledge the work that I'll be talking about is work that I've done with several colleagues. Adrian Carter, who's a postdoctoral fellow who works with me, who's led this work, and we've done it jointly with Emily Bell and Eric Racine from Montreal, who've done a lot of work on the ethics of deep brain stimulation for Parkinson's disease and more recently depression. So what I want to talk about is what deep brain stimulation is and what it's used for, what sort of evidence is being used now to argue for its extension to the treatment of addiction. This is a relatively recent thing that I've become aware of. And I'll talk through some of the issues of whether we should be thinking about trialing DBS in addiction. I'll be generally putting the case for caution, not wanting to argue that there's a bulletproof case that says we should never ever consider this, but it'll be an argument along the lines that we need to know a lot more about this particular technique and the rationale for its use in addiction before we plunge in and do trials. I'll do my best to put the case for a trial and the sort of arguments I think that people might want to put, but my bias is very much in favour of the cautious case. And then I'll finish up with some suggestions about if we were to proceed with trials, what we'd need to do to make sure that they were done in a way that was ethical. So I guess a bit about why addiction is an issue of some public health and social significance. It's an addiction, particularly to alcohol, nicotine, illicit drugs, accounts for a substantial amount of health burden of disease in developed countries like Australia and in the UK, with nicotine out in front, followed by alcohol and illicit drugs. There's a lot of drug-related harms that are particularly likely to be suffered by people who are very heavy users of these drugs and who develop dependence on them, particularly premature death, and that's a major reason for the contribution it makes to the burden of disease. In Australia in 1999, there were well over 1,000 heroin overdose deaths, and in that particular year more deaths occurred as a consequence of heroin use than from motor vehicle accidents involving alcohol. So at times drug use can be a major contributor of health burden in developed countries, and it has been in recent times. We do have a range of treatments for addiction, but they're not fabulously successful. They certainly improve the lot of people who become drug dependent and assist them to become and remain abstinent, and they involve a combination of traditional psychotherapeutic approaches, social support and drug treatments that assist people to withdraw from drugs that they've developed dependence on, to resist the temptation to return to drug use, that is for relapse prevention, and more controversial forms of treatment that involve substitution of drugs of dependence, such as heroin, by longer acting oral forms of opioids like methadone. Many of these are modestly effective, that is, on the whole, they do benefit people who receive them more than not being treated, but a lot of people return to drug use, and there's certainly a minority of people who whose problems prove resistant to these forms of treatment. So there is a good case to be made for looking around for new treatments. It's not as though we've got the problem leaked. Why look at deep brain stimulation? Well, this is a technique that's been around for about 25, 30 years, primarily used to treat serious neurological disorders like Parkinson's disease. And it involves the insertion of electrodes deep into brain structures, usually using stereotactic devices and neuroimaging. And these electrodes are permanently implanted, and electrical stimulation is delivered through the electrodes from implanted batteries or pulse generators. And this is used to treat a variety of symptoms, and the condition for which The best evidence is available is that for Parkinson's disease, the motor symptoms of Parkinson's disease and other motor disorders, including tremor and dystonia. It's increasingly being used, or trialled, I should say, in the treatment of intractable psychiatric disorders, such as Tourette's syndrome, obsessive compulsive disorder, depression, anxiety, and in chronic pain. There are case reports of its use in treatment of obesity, impulsive and violent behaviour, and alcohol dependence. And there's beginning to be a number of people in the neurological area, and some people in the addiction field, saying that we should be thinking about using this treatment in the case of intractable addiction. A bit about the history of the technique. It was first introduced in France in the early 1990s, used on, in a number of cases, case study evidence that was reported. Large series of cases were accumulated in major academic research centres, and randomised controlled trials have only recently been completed. Difficult to do randomised controlled trials of surgical procedures, but they have been done, and this procedure looks to be much more effective than standard medical management. The Food and Drug Administration in the US approved the treatment for Parkinson's disease and essential tremor as long ago as 1997. That was a procedure that involved stimulating the thalamus, and in 2002 the subthalamic nucleus is the target for stimulation in Parkinson's disease. And they provided humanitarian device exemptions, meaning that on the basis of named patients can be treated with this treatment for a limited number of conditions if they get ethics approval and notify the FDA. And there's a number of randomised controlled trials now being mounted in the treatment of intractable depression and obsessive compulsive disorder. Now, in the case of Parkinson's disease, there is a strong case for efficacy and safety of this particular treatment. If people have seen videos that are around, you see patients with severe Parkinson's who've been frozen, they're incapable of moving because of the disease process. With stimulation, they can move freely. Other patients with tremor and severe dystonias disappear on stimulation, so you can see within an individual patient the dramatic response to these forms of treatment. It's typically been used as a treatment of last resort in patients who no longer respond to the conventional treatment, which is dopamine replacement therapy using levodopa or dopamine agonists, or patients who are experiencing very severe adverse side effects from the conventional medication. And in the absence of any other treatment, the prognosis of these patients is very poor, so it's understandable that they're prepared to contemplate the risks of undergoing such surgery. They're now proposing to use the treatment earlier in the disease course, and that's, I guess, raising a different set of issues we might come to later. Cost-effectiveness is not a cheap procedure because it involves a neurosurgical team and stereotactic equipment. The costs are of the order of $50,000 to implant the electrodes initially, and there's substantial amounts of time and money required to, as it were, tune the stimulation to the patient to produce maximum control of symptoms and minimal side effects. Patients also need to be followed because currently the batteries used to stimulate these devices need replacement every couple of years, and patients' response to the treatment sometimes attenuates over time, so that stimulation needs to be adjusted. Even so, the treatment turns out to be cost effective compared to standard medical treatment. This is a European study arguing that it's saved its treatment costs within about 2.5 years of surgery, and that's because of the huge difference in cost in managing patients with conventional best medical therapy as against deep brain stimulation. There are also very substantial improvements in quality of life, and for people who understand what ICERs are, in incremental cost effectiveness ratios that governments in Australia and the UK use to make decisions about whether to publicly subsidise various treatments. This is in the sort of ballpark of expensive treatments, but ones that would probably be subsidised given the severity of the illness and the lack of alternative treatments. Less clear what the longer term harms of the treatment are. It's more reversible than ablative neurosurgery that involves ablating, destroying brain regions, which was the older process that preceded deep brain stimulation. But there are reports and meta-analyses, even at the best centres, of substantial rates of major adverse surgical events, including things like intracerebral hemorrhages and permanent loss of cognitive and motor function, and in a minority of cases, deaths. There's a lot less certainty about its impact on cognitive, behavioural and emotional disturbances, because obviously people with Parkinson's disease develop a lot of these sorts of symptoms as a consequence of their underlying illness, and discriminating the effects of the underlying deterioration of the illness and the effects of this sort of procedure is difficult. There are also some reports of fairly substantial adverse social outcomes and high rates of marital conflict and divorce, and reasonable evidence of increased suicide risk, probably in patients who have, as it were, been given the treatment of last resort and failed to respond. There's nowhere for them to go. That's not surprising, perhaps. There's been a lot of discussion in the neuroethics area literature about the ethics of trialling DBS for other psychiatric disorders, particularly intractable depression, and the sort of criteria that have been suggested here are the ones outlined above, that we need some reasonable evidence that it's likely the intervention will improve the condition or quality of life of treated individuals, and that would typically consist of preclinical evidence from suitable animal models that the procedure is likely to be safe and effective, and to give us some guidance on where you'd locate the electrodes and what sort of stimulation parameters you'd use. Early clinical evidence in humans, preferably long-term studies of its safety in Parkinson's disease or other patients, for example, and some clinical evidence suggestive that it's likely to have effects on addictive behaviour, and as we'll see, there is some case study evidence of that sort. We also need to be persuaded that participants' suffering justified the risks, that we were dealing with patients whose disorders were severely debilitating and where there was a high risk of serious morbidity or mortality, and available treatments had been trialled and shown to be ineffective. I mean, they're not too controversial, fairly obvious. How do we measure those, or measure the issue of addiction against those as a potential candidate for a DBS? Well, there's a lot of preclinical evidence which points to brain mechanisms for reward underlying addictive phenomena. So there's a lot of animal studies of self-stimulation of self-administration of drugs like the opiates, cocaine and alcohol. And there's quite a few animal studies showing stimulation of structures in the midbrain, the subthalamic nucleus, can reduce self-administration of drugs like cocaine, and that lesions also abolish self-administration. So there's suggestive evidence from animal studies that stimulating these areas might have some sort of impact on self-administration of drugs and addictive behaviour. But there's a variety of sites that can be stimulated, and there's no real consensus on what would be the most sensible site. I gave a talk on this earlier this week in London at the Institute of Psychiatry, and one of the leading animal researchers, Ian Stollerman, who'd done a lot of this work, who thought that it was way too premature to be thinking about potential sites for stimulation. He thought there was a potential to do animal work that might identify sites, but he didn't think the available literature was good enough to do that. So suggestive evidence pointing in the direction it might be a useful approach, but a long way away from. In the case of Parkinson's, for example, there are good animal models of Parkinson's disease. You can use drugs that abolish or that lesion particular areas of the brain and reproduce movement disorders in animals like those in humans. And a lot of the preclinical work that was done around DBS was done on that sort to locate target areas, but we haven't really got that at the moment for addictive behaviour. What we do have, and what's commonly cited, are these sorts of clinical reports of improvements in patients with Parkinson's disease, treated for their Parkinson's disease, who display various forms of addictive behaviour that improve after DBS. So in the first case, there's a phenomenon that's described as dopamine dysregulation syndrome, in which patients with Parkinson's disease use the medications that are used to treat the disorder in a way that resembles that of a cocaine addict. That is, they escalate their doses and continue to use these drugs in ways that often harm and produce severe side effects, and they persist in doing that. and often deny the use and hoard medication and doctor shop and so on. So there's been a couple of patients with Parkinson's disease with this particular syndrome treated with the deep brain stimulation of subthalamic nucleus, and in two of those cases this syndrome was abolished. But in a larger series, there wasn't a lot of evidence to suggest that it had any specific effect on that. The other type of addictive behaviour seen in Parkinson's patients, and this is interesting in its own right, are these impulse control disorders that are somewhere of the order of 10 to 20% of Parkinson's patients treated with dopamine agonists develop these compulsive behaviours. They become problem gamblers or engage in bizarre, unusual sexual activity, or become overeaters and put on huge amounts of weight. These disorders typically remit with the cessation of dopamine replacement, but given that that's an important part of the treatment of Parkinson's disease, it's a difficult issue for a lot of these patients. So deep brain stimulation has been trialled in Parkinson's patients displaying these sorts of disorders as a consequence of their medication, and there's been some mixed results here. An example of one patient who's a problem gambler whose behaviour disappeared after they were treated with DBS. It's a bit unclear whether it's a specific effect of DBS or it's an effect of withdrawing the medication, which is of course possible after people have been successfully treated. There's also examples, however, of patients being treated with DBS developing compulsive behaviour like that with dopamine. So it's a bit unclear at the moment what the effect is. And there's also one report of a patient with DBS engaging in self-stimulation like that of Olds rats. The Olds rats were rats with electrodes implanted in the forebrain who would press a lever to stimulate themselves to the point of exhaustion. The so-called pleasure centre being stimulated is an example of that occurring in a Parkinson's patient as well. So you wouldn't want to hang too much on those sorts of reports for this being a necessary and effective treatment of addiction, because the outcomes, very small numbers, are in both directions. The other sort of evidence that's often invoked is very recent experience. Well, there's an old literature of neurosurgery for heroin addiction going back to the 60s and 70s, mainly in India, but more recently in Russia and China, there have been reports of patients given ablative neurosurgery for heroin addiction. In the case of Russia, this involved bilateral cingulotomies, severing the tracts in that part of the brain, purportedly blocking obsessional thoughts about drugs. And in China, they had 500 patients that had the nucleus accumbens, the so-called reward center, ablated on both sides of the brain to abolish the rewarding effects of heroin. In both of these cases, these procedures were done in the private sector, and it's perhaps not a surprise that both have been performed in countries where issues of human rights and informed consent are not high on people's agenda. The quality of the research leaves a lot to be desired. It's really only the Chinese that have attempted to publish the results of this research, and they're uncontrolled studies. Certainly they report that people lose interest in heroin. It's not clear what else they lose interest in and what other effects and consequences it has in their lives generally. The other big worry about this is this occurs in settings where people who are heroin dependent don't have access to effective forms of treatment. The argument in the Chinese case is these people have failed treatment, meaning they've failed to remain abstinent after being withdrawn from heroin. And we know that's the norm. It's not a treatment for heroin addiction. But nonetheless, people who are arguing for DBS are saying, well, if this is what happens when you perform ablative neurosurgery, then perhaps we could get the same sorts of benefits with deep brain stimulation that doesn't involve ablating or destroying those areas and is potentially reversible. So we've had a series of case reports of favourable impacts of deep brain stimulation on addiction in persons treated for other psychiatric disorders. So, for example, a woman treated for severe anxiety disorder by Kern had no effect on her anxiety disorder, but she reported en passant that she no longer was interested in drinking. They published that. And there's been similar reports on smoking cessation in patients with Tourette's syndrome, anxiety and obsessive compulsive disorder who've been treated with DBS finding it easy to quit. These are all sort of adventitious reports that the treatment wasn't intended to produce these effects, and it's just been reported in passing. There's been one study reported in the literature of three patients with alcohol dependence who have more than 10 years duration, who were described as treatment refractory, who were given deep brain stimulation through electrodes located in the nucleus accumbens, and they reported reductions in craving for alcohol. And at 1 year follow-up, two of them were absent, and the other was drinking a lot less than he had been before. So that's the sum total of the evidence so far. And it's, I guess I don't need to say, it's hardly compelling. It doesn't bowl you over with the positive nature of it. We're talking about very short-term effects in small numbers of people, no control groups, unblinded evaluation, and no real attempt to follow up, with the exception of that 1 year follow-up with the alcohol-dependent patients. And real concern about publication bias. That's an issue in these sorts of procedures, the extent to which people only report the good news. Well, what arguments we have then for looking more critically at whether we should be trialling DBS for addiction? Well, arguably the first requirement, we're a long way from satisfying that. We don't have evidence anywhere near as good as was the case for Parkinson's disease. We know there's a significant risk of harm from deep brain stimulation. There's limited and conflicting evidence of benefit for humans. The preclinical evidence just isn't there, and the human evidence, the study evidence, is incredibly thin. We also had a history of past sort of adventures in neurosurgical treatment in psychiatry, including addiction, which should give us pause before we go down this particular route. The second concern about a lot of this, and it's reflected in the Chinese and Russian experience, is it's not really clear that we're dealing with as compelling a case for a condition that's otherwise untreatable. In the case of Parkinson's disease, for example, the treatment was reserved for patients who'd failed at conventional treatment, who clearly had an irreversible and progressive neurodegenerative disease. There was no real other options available for them. They had a particularly unpleasant fate in front of them, and understandably, they were prepared to contemplate fairly drastic and heroic interventions of this sort. And in the absence of these sorts of interventions, they were going to die and be severely poor and severely disabled in the time that it took to die. But in the case of addiction, we've got a lot of treatments that are available. They might not be fabulously effective, but they're ones that we should be prepared to try before we embark on heroic interventions of this sort. As is well known, the course of addictive disorders is far from certain. A lot of people do recover without treatment, and do recover over time. We can substantially reduce the risks of a lot of forms of addiction, even if we can't successfully treat people, particularly with opiate substitution for heroin, for example. And the bigger problem for a lot of people with addiction is not sort of failing to respond to treatment, it's getting access to decent treatment in the first place. So we'd be willing to argue there'd be a higher moral priority to ensuring adequate funding of existing treatment before people were put in for a trial of this sort. So I guess to sum up the case for caution, we're not in a position where we should be thinking about doing these trials at the moment. The animal evidence just isn't there to identify optimal targets and stimulation parameters or to provide a rationale for this treatment. There's no real consensus amongst the experts on what sorts of brain regions should be targeted. There's good evidence of efficacy in Parkinson's disease, but the long-term safety of the condition really needs to be better understood. And we need much better evidence on the effects of this sort of intervention on addictive behaviour in patients with other disorders. And there's quite a lot of comorbidity, so it should be possible to get some sort of idea on that. And clearly we'd need, if we were to proceed with trials, to think very clearly about the sort of independent oversight to ensure that there were no abuses of patients. And Schlaper and Finns have recently advocated in the Journal of the American Medical Association that we need, and they're not talking about addiction in this case, they're talking about DBS for other conditions, that there should be some form of register of all cases treated with these interventions to minimise selective publication, in much the same way as we now require prior registration of clinical trials so that drug companies don't selectively report results of drugs. Well, what might be said on the other side of the argument? And these are the sort of arguments I've heard from some colleagues. That, okay, we don't have the animal evidence now, but it wouldn't be hard to get it if we're prepared to invest in doing that sort of research. There is reasonable evidence of long-term safety of DBS and Parkinson's disease. There's an argument often made. We've treated something with the order of 70,000 patients with DBS for Parkinson's disease worldwide. To which my rejoinder would be, we only really know about the outcomes of about 5,000 of those who've been treated in medical centres, and we don't really have follow-ups much beyond about 7 or 8 years in some cases. So it's still very early days, and if you think about drug adverse effects of drugs, we need to see and study a large number of people before we can be confident about that. They'd also argue, as I think I've indicated, that there is some case study evidence, and the evidence from treatment, neurosurgical treatment, is suggestive. And of course, it's not impossible to get together groups of experts to oversight these things or to comply with registers. Now, a potent motive that's often mentioned is the sixth here. That if this treatment were successful, it would appropriately medicalise addiction and assist addicted people to be less stigmatised, ostracised and mistreated. And that's often a very potent argument or motive, I should say, for people to promote this form of treatment. I guess the seventh reason there is one that was thrown up when I spoke earlier this week. Well, if we don't do it, then people will be doing it in other settings which are even worse, so it's best that it's out in the open in free societies where we could appropriately study the procedure and assess its benefits and harms. And the eighth one is a fairly standard rejoinder, I guess, to the expense or the current expense of the treatment, that costs are likely to come down as experience develops and the technologies more routinised. Okay, well, I might just finish up by sort of looking at, if a trial were to be seen as justifiable, what would it look like? How would we go about it? And these are some of the issues I think we'd need to talk about and debate. Who are appropriate candidates for this sort of treatment? How would we go about enrolling them? And how would we go about designing the sort of treatment package within which DBS might fit? So patient selection, we'd clearly be restricting it to patients who were severely dependent, who experienced significant personal harm as a result of their addiction and had repeatedly failed to respond to the best available treatment. What sort of addiction should be given priority? And there was an interesting discussion of this earlier in the week at the Institute of Psychiatry. The view there was that if we were going to trial this, it would probably be stimulant dependence, cocaine, methamphetamine, largely because we don't have effective treatments currently for those forms of drug dependence, and people with it who don't respond to existing psychosocial treatment interventions do get into serious strife and suffer major adverse health consequences. There was a lot of scepticism about its value in likely value in treatment of alcohol dependence and opioid dependence, given that we do have more effective forms of psychosocial and pharmacological treatment for those forms of dependence. But that would be an issue, I guess, that would need to be debated. We clearly need to take some special trouble to ensure that people gave informed consent to participation in such trials, that they had a capacity to understand the risks and benefits of the treatment, they were free to make the decision, and free in this case, particularly in the context of addiction, meaning uncoerced. I'll come back to that in a minute. That they were fully informed of risks and benefits and clearly had access to the best treatment for their condition before they were offered this intervention. Now, in the case of addiction, it's not always a trivial matter to decide whether people have the capacity to give free and informed consent, because certainly some forms of drug dependence, particularly alcohol and the stimulants, can produce changes in brain function that impair people's capacity to consent. Most obviously when they're in the process of withdrawing from the drug or intoxicated, but they can often suffer cognitive incapacity or impaired cognitive performance, even when they've completed withdrawal and are sober and not affected by drugs. They may also have comorbid serious psychiatric disorders, particularly severe depression. So we'd have to be very careful to ensure that people weren't impaired in any of those ways in making a decision. The coercion issue is a real one, particularly with illicit drugs and drugs like the stimulants that a lot of patients are ambivalent about giving up their drug use and often enter treatment under strong coercion from families and partners. They can on occasion be under explicit forms of coercion by employers or in the case of people who've been charged with offences through courts. Or in some cases, parents might undergo treatment in an attempt to retain custody of children. The big problem, I guess, with this, and it's an issue that's been identified in Parkinson's disease by Eric Racine and Emily Bell, is the media coverage of this form of treatment creates incredible expectations about a miracle cure. And there's often a lot of pressure put on people to undergo the treatment, and there are major challenges that are reported by people involved in doing DBS with Parkinson's disease in managing patient expectations. So this is likely to be an issue here. One can imagine it won't take many media shows of people waking up cured of their heroin addiction to create public demand and clamour for access to this form of treatment. We've seen it before. With so-called cures for heroin addiction involve anaesthetising people for 24 hours and flushing their opiate receptors out with an opiate antagonist, which an enterprising Israeli intensivist marketed for, I think, $15,000 to $20,000. The other issue here is ensuring access to effective treatments. And as I mentioned before, this is a major impediment to treatment of addiction at the moment in many countries. There's underfunding of addiction treatment. There's often moral objections to, and in some countries like the Soviet Union or the former Soviet Union and Russia and China, effective forms of substitution treatment are banned by law. Patients are not allowed to have access to methadone or buprenorphine, for example. And even when these treatments are legally allowed, they're often badly or poorly provided with sort of in a punitive setting. With limited psychosocial support. So we want to be sure that anyone contemplating entry to a DBS trial had really been given a good chance to be treated effectively. The other issue that concerns me about these are opportunity costs of these sorts of trials. There's a sort of economic cost. I sit and chair a subcommittee that makes decisions about public subsidy of medications in Australia. Aware of the expense and the difficult decisions that governments increasingly have to make in choosing between expensive treatments for different drug treatments for different conditions, and the average cost of a lot of treatments is going up. So we're talking here about a treatment, as I mentioned earlier, $50,000 to $60,000 US and sort of front end costs, and large scale randomised controlled trials of this form of intervention will be difficult to do. It will take time to accumulate sufficient numbers of patients to have an adequate trial size to enable us to decide whether it's effective. There will be a fairly expensive process of ensuring that people who participate in such trials give free and informed consent. There's also substantial economic costs, the costs of doing trials on DBS for addiction as against doing clinical trials of other forms of treatment for addiction or randomised controlled trials of DBS for other neurological conditions. Those are all opportunity costs that we'd have to think about. And at the end of the day, you begin to wonder about the opportunity costs of using the treatment. Even if it goes through trial and is shown to be effective, it's likely to be very expensive, and it's going to be an option that's going to be fairly severely rationed. And you wonder about whether it's something that we should be embarking on when there are other forms of treatment that could be provided to larger numbers of people with greater benefit. So just some closing comments on likely cost effectiveness in addiction. As I've argued earlier, I think the evidence is fairly compelling that it is cost-effective in Parkinson's disease, but that's because we're talking about a really severe debilitating disease which is expensive to treat. We're talking here about a much more common disorder with a broader range of severity, where there's a real minority of individuals who might be as severely affected by their addiction as is the case with Parkinson's disease. In the case of cost effectiveness, there's an interesting issue here that's already arisen in the case of heroin maintenance treatment for heroin addiction, but that also proves to be a fairly expensive intervention, but not for the same reasons as deep brain stimulation. But the economic analyses there suggest that it pays for itself because of the crime that it prevents. And there are interesting, I guess, social policy issues around whether we think that the cost effectiveness of medical interventions ought to be justified by their impact on the criminality or criminal behaviour of people who are drug dependent. And there will also be substantial costs in providing proper psychosocial support and follow-up care for people who are treated this way, because the brain changes underlying addiction are the easy part. There are major psychosocial issues that affect the lives of people who develop severe forms of addiction, and the sense of criminal records, lack of education and skills, and difficulty in finding employment, high rates of comorbid psychiatric disorder, and family breakdown. Well, I might finish there because I think there's plenty of opportunity for discussion here, and just run out for questions and discussion.
Thanks a lot, Wayne. That was fantastic. We've got plenty of time for some questions. Maybe I'll take advantage of the situation to kick this off. One of the things I got from your talk was just that it seems as though the only reasons we have for thinking that this will work as a treatment for addiction is the fact that people stopped using drugs. Is there any kind of theoretical rationale behind it? And, you know, if not, do you think it matters, ethically speaking?
What, the lack of a mechanism?
Yeah.
Well, there's plenty of examples of empirical treatments in psychiatry, ECT being one of the foremost, based on a rationale that proved to be erroneous, but nonetheless effective. I guess I've become more and more an empiricist with old age, and evidence trumps theory all the time. But I think the theory is something that people rely fairly heavily on here because of the animal models, particularly of the reward pathways and the plausibility. And certainly the Chinese and Russian neurosurgery appealed explicitly to the animal model, saying we're going to operate on the reward systems and that's going to abolish the craving and the addiction. So a large part of the rationale, whether it proves to be true or not, hangs on that sort of animal evidence. And that's a lot of what's driving people's interest in this particular approach to treatment.
Right. We'll take one from Julian and then from Steve and then from us.
So wouldn't you think the ethical justification for this would be stronger than in Parkinson's disease? Because you mentioned the crime at the end, but people with Parkinson's disease don't hurt other people, whereas people who are addicts do harm other people, and alcoholics cause...
Yeah.
So once you factor all of that in, might it be a very strong argument to get on with this kind of research? And to take a kind of parallel example, I understand that hormonal castration is offered to paedophiles. In fact, I think in Czechoslovakia they actually surgically castrate paedophiles. And this is offered as an option to imprisonment. So if it were effective, why would you worry that it would be a part of the criminal justice system? Why wouldn't you offer it just as some places offer castration as an alternative?
Well, we're talking here about a medical treatment primarily. I mean, if you see it as a criminal justice intervention, I think it would raise a whole series of different issues and be a different set of arguments. But primarily it's being advocated as a medical treatment for the benefit of the individual patient rather than because of the social benefits that might flow from reduction in third-party effects.
Why wouldn't you consider the third-party effects?
Well, it's a fairly expensive way to get it, I guess. I hadn't thought about it. I've been evaluating it primarily as a medical intervention. I'd be pretty uneasy about, invasive procedures generally. I wouldn't be too enthusiastic about castration or the chemical or surgical for paedophiles either. I might be persuaded. I'm not ruling it out in principle, but I think the bar would have to be fairly high to raise that. But I guess if you're thinking about it purely in social consequences, a fairly strict utilitarian appraisal, you might well say, well, yeah, it could be justified on third-party benefits.
Yeah. So I was interested in the international argument. You sort of raised that very quickly, and I think you were dismissive.
The one about it better off doing it in a democratic country than allowing it to happen elsewhere.
Yeah. So I mean, there's two versions of this, right? There's a kind of economic one where we better do it first, otherwise the competition will get it.
Well, I don't think it's that. It's better doing it out in the open. So
the stronger one seems to be this ethical one.
Yeah.
So from what you might put it this way, though, Russians and Chinese are already out there doing something more extreme, apparently. So wouldn't it be a good idea to say, look, rather than going in and actually damaging people's brains, you could just do, we'll go ahead and help develop procedure that's less invasive and has less long-term consequences, present this as an ethical alternative.
Well, that's certainly a view that's been put. I didn't mean to be dismissive of it, but certainly there is an argument to be made along those lines. What's to be said in reply to that? Well, the Russians and Chinese have done it, but even the Russians and Chinese governments have been uneasy about it, and the Russian government stopped it. And the Chinese government did the same. There was quite a lot of unease about it within China as well.
So they definitely stopped it then?
Well, it's a bit hard to know, and they're a closed society, but officially there have been newspaper stories saying that the government had made a decision that it ought to be stopped. I don't know whether I can take credit for that, but I certainly editorialised about it around the time that this was going on. And there was also a journalist in the... was it the Asian Wall Street Journal who was publicising a lot of what was going on, not just for addiction. The Chinese were also performing lobotomies for schizophrenia and a lot of other mental disorders, so there was a lot of concern about fairly gung-ho neurosurgeons operating on a broad range of patient conditions there. So I don't think it's as clear that it's continuing. It certainly was done in that sort of in those country settings. So it's not clear that it's continuing. I guess the other worry about that sort of logic is you could imagine people doing something even worse somewhere else and that being used as a justification for doing something a little less bad in the hopes of delivering a treatment. I'd be uneasy about that as a rationale for it. I mean, I've been through this argument in a non-academic context when we... 12 years ago we had the visiting Israeli intensivist in Australia who did blitz the daytime television programs and talkback radio saying that he had a cure for heroin addiction. 100% success rate. And you can imagine the pressure that came from desperate families and addicted individuals on government to trial it. And that was, a hard one. In retrospect, I think that was a case where we probably should have said, okay, we're unconvinced, but let's do a trial. The difficulty was the people who were interested in promoting it weren't serious about doing trials because they said they didn't want to waste time doing research. They knew it worked, they wanted to save lives. So it can be often difficult in that sort of setting to know how to respond to those sorts of claims. And abuses, whether abuses in other places might justify, not so much an abuse here, but going down a route with an invasive form of treatment in the hope of heading off something worse somewhere else. But yeah, I mean, I think there is a discussion and debate to be had around that. I didn't mean to dismiss it.
Okay, we've got it. We had Mark, and then I'll...
Wayne, thanks very much for that. I notice I'm the fourth Australian in a row. I'm sorry about that. I just wanted to say a little bit more about the evidence, the animal evidence in favour of it.
Mm-hmm.
Of the deep brain stimulation for addiction, because it seemed, the way in which I thought your argument was, I mean, the argument seemed to go for RCTs in humans, against RCTs in humans overall, but unless the animal evidence is already there, it seemed also to be an argument against any program of research into using deviant. I mean, this is, I'm thinking about the last couple of slides you've got here. Looked like an argument against this as an agenda, a research agenda.
Oh, no.
As much as anything else.
No, no. I mean, I just don't think the animal research is there that, that would provide a rationale for it the way that similar animal research did provide a rationale for this procedure in Parkinson's disease. It, it would be possible to, you know, to specify the type of research. And in fact, when I talked earlier in the week, there was some discussion of what sort of research that would look like. And the argument was we'd have to be in higher primates, that rat models would not be good.
Right.
That, that you, you could process, you know, and you, you know, you could probably explore a variety of sites, stimulation sites, to see what effect that had on self-administration of drugs. So, no, I didn't mean to be suggesting that I'd be opposed to doing animal research on it. I just don't think the animal research is there at the moment.
I mean, so, so do you think these, are, these, I mean, these broader arguments about the sort of the cost effectiveness, those sorts of questions, that, so the human context of the disease and the cost issues, do you, I mean, so what occurred to me was that maybe that might undermine the cost benefit analysis for doing the research on the animals in the first place. So that given you go use primates and you're doing this to primates for something that might not be funded, even if it worked.
Well, that'd be my view. I mean, and certainly if, you know, I were making decisions about funding allocations for research in this sort of area, that'd be an argument I'd put. I don't know what the attitude would be of funding bodies, but that's pretty much, I guess, where I'm coming from. You're sort of thinking that, you know, even in the best world, the animal model works done, we identify sites, we show that the stimulation of these sites abolishes self-administration of drugs and that there aren't severe adverse consequences, and you're thinking, well, yeah, even all that in its favour, and we do the trials, then it's going to be incredibly expensive, and we're going to have treatment at the end of the day that's going to be applied to a minuscule fraction of people who are drug dependent.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd be, you know, if we're thinking about resource allocation, we'd be better off thinking about less expensive interventions. So I guess that's that would be an argument I would mount. So we're not wanting to suggest that, you know, there's a compelling reason saying this is absolutely immoral and unethical and we should never think about it. So it, that's pretty much, I guess, where I'm coming from.
I think we had a question here and then one over there after that.
I'm involved in DBS for PD and also a pain, and I have actually been to Xi'an where they did some of these experiments you're talking about. But what I would like to ask is why you've gone immediately for DBS, because actually lesioning is much cheaper. Most of your cost-effective arguments will fall away. And I personally think, though I can't really say for it with any certainty, that the, some of the patients I saw were temporarily, maybe they had their addiction had gone, according to their relatives. Admittedly, it was all through a translator, so I can't be certain that that was so. And also, I was particularly interested as to whether they'd be all their motivation would be reduced because they were lesioning the nucleus accumbens, which we know is important for motivation.
Yeah.
And the answer was no, they had normal sex lives, etc., etc.
Mm.
Now, I think a trial of deep brain lesioning of the nucleus accumbens is ethically, would be ethically justified on the basis of those results if they're true. And you never discuss that.
Well, I think there are real doubts about how good the data are, and I think the argument would be that, you know, okay, there might be a case to be made for it as a end line, third or fourth line treatment, but there are plenty of other things we could do before that.
That was the same argument you made for DBS. My argument is that if it were the case that lesioning is as effective and so much cheaper, then why not consider that?
Well, I guess that the field tends to have moved against lesioning, and a lot of the arguments in favour.
You know, well, actually, you say that, but there's never been a proper study of lesioning versus DBS,
it's an interesting observation. I mean, the consensus statement I've recently seen on DBS does say that there is a case for lesioning as a treatment, as an option for patients who might prefer it to having implanted electrodes and all that.
We regularly do it in third world countries, and that you may argue is unethical, but on the other hand, there's no evidence that it's any worse than deep brain stimulation.
Right. No, that's an interesting case. I hadn't thought of that, because most of the, certainly the recent case that's been made for this intervention has been promoting DBS as a more reversible variety of...
Well, it's certainly more reversible, but that doesn't mean it's safe.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, we had one over here.
Yeah, I was just interested whether you think that how many of these arguments would also apply to using DBS for depression. You suggested that that if patients with addiction have depression, that might impair their ability to give consent. Obviously, depression is a very widespread problem with significant social and personal burden. We also have reasonably good treatments for depression that don't involve DBS. And I wonder whether you think that DBS for depression is ethically justified.
Well, I don't want to say any of this is ethically unjustified. Just to clarify, I'm not saying that I think it's unethical in principle to be lesioning or performing DBS.
Let me rephrase the question.
Yeah.
Do you think that there's the evidence would support doing RCTs for depression? RCTs for DBS and depression?
Yeah, I haven't had I know there's a large literature on that, it's something that's on my list to look at. Because there has been quite a bit of discussion of exactly that issue as to whether we should be going down this route.
There is one going on.
Oh, yeah, there's trials. There are trials, and I know there's trials in Brisbane where I am, and as well as in Montreal and in a lot of countries. So the trials are underway, and they're not much interested in what my views are. And they're not likely to be persuasive. I haven't really thought that through, but I think you're right, that a lot of the arguments would be fairly similar. I guess we'd be looking at, in the case of depression, it's intractable depression, people whose treatment would be resistant. And for those sort of severe forms of depression, the story starts to look a lot like that of Parkinson's disease, and that people would often be hospitalised for long periods of time, they'd be actively suicidal and really in a miserable sort of condition. So for those patients in that sort of circumstance, then the case for procedure starts to look more plausible. But I guess the difficulty is, with addiction and depression, we're looking at a range of severity, and it's a minority of affected people who've got the more severe disorders who'd be candidates.
And do you think that impairs their ability to give properly informed consent?
I think that's a tricky one. I mean, the temptation is to just sort of say, well, anyone who's prepared to consent is, by definition, incapable of consenting, which is... Well, how it's been resolved in New South Wales and Australia, you're not allowed to undergo psychosurgery or deep brain stimulation because the Act says that nobody who'd be of sound mind would consent to such a thing. So I think there are real risks in setting the standard for consent so high that we deprive people who may benefit from those procedures from it. I think in that sort of case, you'd really want some sort of proxy procedure with some disinterested parties involved to make sure that this was a procedure that was in the patient's best interest. So I wouldn't want to rule it out.
So presumably, in theory, one could meet such a criterion for somebody who's addicted.
Yeah, I think
as well.
Yeah, if we did go down the route, I think that's probably what we'd do for really severe cases. And I imagine that initially that's what the trials would be done on patients with disorders of that severity.
Well, it's moved on a bit. I was going back to your exchange with John Stein about lesioning. Maybe you don't know, I thought he might know whether there are animal models, whether in animal models of addiction lesioning has been tried.
Well, in abolishing self-administration, yes. That was some of the earlier evidence there.
But what about some of the animal models of addiction are about acquiring these stimulus-driven motivations through basic administration of cocaine or
basic... Yeah, just by animals are taught to self-administer cocaine and just given access to it and develop and respond, typically bar press or some other action at a high rate, and they'll continue to do that when the drug's withdrawn for quite a while. So that's the analogue, I guess, of self-administration with high frequency in addiction. There's debate about how good an analogue it is, but it certainly has face validity if you look at an animal that's banging away at a bar.
So the bit that's done in some of the animal models of addiction where you train in the context of some stimulus and then you remove both the cocaine, and you remove any of the cocaine feedback and then you just produce the stimulus and you see that you don't get any extinction at all.
Yeah, yeah,
so
yeah, yeah. Sort of place
where,
yeah.
stops that stimulus.
I don't know. I think it's been more around self-administration that's been abolished rather than that sort of place.
That one,
yeah. Ian Stolomans, I think I mentioned, was in the audience. He's done a lot of work on stimulant drugs, and he didn't think that the evidence was good enough to start embarking on human trials.
I would just comment that we should be a little bit hesitant about drawing too much of an analogue with those self-administering animals, because you have to go through quite some hoops to get animals to self-administer in a way that looks like addiction, whereas with human beings we come to it quite naturally. So there are questions, serious questions about that. Anders, do you have a question?
So it seems like the placebo effect here must be really massive, of course. The bigger the intervention, the stronger the placebo effect, and putting electrodes in the brain seems to be one of the most dramatic ways to do that. So that would suggest that ideally, of course, one should be doing sham surgery to test it, and that's ethically also problematic, but also very likely actually probably to have some positive effects.
Well, you could, there is an inbuilt placebo control in the Parkinson's disease, because you can look at the patient with the stimulation on and off under double-blind conditions. And it's very clear that when the stimulation's off, they have severe disorder, and when it's on, the disorder disappears. And I guess that's a large part of why people have been so impressed with DBS, because it's so you can make videos of patients and you can see a dramatic response. There's not going to be any obvious analog for that with either depression, or maybe depression if people are in constant severe distress, possibly, if the depressive symptoms are relieved. Not as obvious for addiction, unless, you know, I guess you could possibly provoke self-reported craving by exposing people to stimuli and see whether that changes with the stimulation on and off. But it's a lot easier, it has been a lot easier in Parkinson's disease than it's likely to be in depression or addiction or chronic pain, perhaps, if it's episodic rather than constant. But yeah, that's a challenge with all forms of surgery. The ethics of what's an appropriate control, and the randomised control trials that have been done on DBS have been open label. Patients know that they've had DBS, and they've sent other people treating them.
Julian, you had another question.
So here's an argument for less caution during this trial.
Yeah.
There must be at least in principle possible to modify behaviours by modifying brain activity. So, I mean, it's just the question is when we get there, and this is probably very early.
Yeah.
It seems like a reasonable way to go forwards. And what the only reason that you really need a randomised controlled trial is to prove effectiveness and to evaluate cost effectiveness for questions of distribution of health resources within the government funded health system. But from the patient's perspective, they may have great interest in just taking part in this kind of research because the effects might be profound. So from a libertarian perspective, provided that the research is funded by the researchers or is paid for by the patient, you're enhancing people's options by offering them the opportunity to take part in this kind of program. So the issue of depression was mentioned before, but end-stage addiction, seems to me that you can pretty easily straight away, just provide you provide the facts and you've got competent people, get some research going in this area. And you only really need this large randomised controlled trials if you really want to make this a part of a national health system.
Well, that's true. I mean, if you're a libertarian and you don't bother with prescription systems, and you're sort of caveat emptor and let by everywhere.
But that would serve the public good of getting research done.
Well,
it would enhance the options available to people with severe disorders, and it would put us in a position to later do the randomised controlled trials.
Well, assuming the people doing the procedure are likely to report the good and the bad news.
That's
it works with the drug regulatory system very well, doesn't it?
Well, this is going to be different to the
trial. Precisely, you're talking about big money here and the incentives that people would have to cover up mistakes and report good results. I mean, that's the big worry, I think. But I think this is likely to happen in the US, where you've got people who are prepared to pay that sort of money and providers who are prepared to provide it. And you know, if you look at where the ablative surgery has already happened, it's where people have paid for it. It hasn't been provided by government. So I think you're right, that's the circumstance under which it's most likely to happen. And I guess if you're a libertarian, that doesn't matter. I mean, the legal system sorts out the harms afterwards. People can always sue them if they get into trouble. And it's caveat emptor, people assume the risk they pay for the surgery and it's their problem. But we don't live in, well, most of us don't live in societies like that at the moment. And I guess that I was taking for granted that we were assuming something like the NHS or a publicly subsidised system where, well, I guess that's the other issue. The unstated thing here is the number of people who had serious addictions who could afford to pay for this sort of treatment would be vanishingly small. So if you're wanting to have any impact on addiction as a public health problem, then you'd really have to be subsidising it to increase access to it.
Kind of follows on from that. I just wondered whether you could expand on the nutrition cost thing. So, how much money do we currently spend on research into treatments and kind of like compared to what it would cost to do a proper randomized trial?
Can't give a precise answer to it, any of those questions, but we don't spend as much as we should. I mean, we don't fund a lot of clinical trials for sort of more prevalent conditions, and clinical trials involving drugs, which are a lot more straightforward than this, are probably underfunded at the moment. I mean, I guess if you're a neurosurgeon, you'd be arguing the case for doing trials, and they have been funded. I guess in the midst of a global financial crisis, these are tough decisions that will have to be made by funding bodies as to where priorities are. And if you were thinking about it from a public health point of view and in terms of bang for the buck and impact on disease burden, then you'd be looking at funding trials of treatments that are likely to be relatively inexpensive, easy to deliver, likely to have a big population impact by reducing the disease and disease burden of substantial proportion of the population. And I guess by those sorts of standards, surgical interventions which are incredibly expensive and are likely to be applied to a minority of a severely affected patients start to look like a much lower priority. That'd be pretty much the sort of line I guess I've been implicitly arguing. I think it was spelled out for me by the question earlier, made me spell it out a bit more explicitly.
All right, well, if there are no other questions, I suppose we'll thank Professor Hall for... for those of you who are on the list for dinner, that's at 7 o'clock at Chiang Mai. But it's traditional to go over to Little Gate House for a cup of tea, so if anybody wants to join us, that's where we'll be heading first.
I should have mentioned there's actually some publications, papers in press. Anyone who's interested?
You've been working on
it. Yeah. I've been there. It's been coming out. It's kind of a good time with us.
Yeah.
Sort of